themes of today's journalism histories, which really can be probably summed up by the one word, liberation, and the sense of liberation as freedom. And the cover there from Oz magazine, very much at the heart of the countercultural movement in the late 60s, as we'll see in this particular session, clearly relating to the land Australia, but also perhaps more intriguingly, perhaps carrying with it connotations of the land of Oz, the Wizard of Oz, the Yellow Brick Road, and various other aspects. But in this particular instance, it's certainly using, in terms of the iconography, a kind of synonym, a visual synonym, for what you get in terms of DAS washing up liquid or washing up water, etc. With clearly the sense of female energy there, driving out stains, washes whitest ever. I'm sure those of you who can remember a few weeks ago when we screened the advert for Kellogg's, seared in your mind and still available on Blackboard, one of the sort of aspects that really is kind of at the heart of the women's liberation movement, and also, interestingly enough, how gay rights has developed as well. The two have had some interesting parallels in terms of how they've evolved over the last five decades. But to really start addressing this whole issue, I want to dial back slightly and again start setting the scene in terms of what Britain was actually like in, as I say, what is now the regarded not just as the baby boomer generation, but also the post-imperial generation. And it's a fair statement to argue that actually, by most conventional accounts, people had been, in the main, very repressed about sex and sexuality in the 1950s. The broad themes were as follows. Sex in marriage was okay. Sex between unmarried teenagers was certainly not okay. And sex between men was illegal. Now, that was a state of affairs that went way back to the moral panics of the Victorians, where clearly we had a reaction against what were seen as unnatural practices and so on. And yet, a century or so later, in the 1960s, we get a decade which quite clearly relates to a sexual revolution. At the time, premarital sex becoming common, abortion, contraception being on demand, homosexuality became legalised and acceptable, and Britain was never the same again. Now, those are the broad brushstrokes. Actually, I'm fairly certain, in fact, I would like to state quite categorically, that's much too simple a picture. The 1950s, as I said, did actually see quite high levels of ignorance about sexuality. We can see this simply by looking at the records of illegitimate births, illegal abortions, shotgun marriages, and indeed, if we look at the New Wave series of books that we looked at a few weeks ago, they were very much addressing those kind of issues, the disastrous relationships, people having unrealistic expectations, and the challenges that society was facing as a result of that general dissatisfaction with life and so on. Many British children actually received no sex education from their parents, and the schools certainly didn't provide any alternative. Sex simply was not a subject for discussion. At the same time, possibly again in the aftermath of the Second World War, and even during the Second World War, because after all, if you're going to die, it's a kind, can act as a kind of aphrodisiac after a fashion. I wouldn't recommend it, but it's just a thought. In terms of that whole sequence, we did have a notion that people were having sex outside marriage during the war years, and indeed after the war years. And contraception, although not necessarily freely available, it was available. Thanks to the work of this young lady, Marie Stopes. Now, Marie Stopes actually opened the UK's first ever family planning clinic, which was called the Mother's Clinic. And it was opened at 61 Marlborough Road, North London, in March 1921. Now, again, if you're drawing parallels and unpeeling that, you'll see this is quite interesting, because just as after the First World War, when women had gone out to work and came back and were put back into a domestic situation, you're kind of seeing a mirroring of this in the Second World War and so on and so forth. Certainly in terms of the development of suffragettes as well, and areas with respect to that, and the notion of female empowerment and equality, perhaps, more importantly. Marie Stopes sold hundreds of thousands of advice manuals. And actually, as early as 1930, the Church of England voted to allow contraception, which made life a lot easier for women who didn't want large families. It's again one of the key aspects in terms of things were you usually had to have several spares because of childhood mortality rates, issues within that whole side of things. But actually, why would you want to simply have a large family if, you know, literally there was no need for it, and so on and so forth. And as ever, knowledge is an economic sort of aspect, and textbooks about sex were a thriving market. A thriving underground market. Well, not necessarily underground, but sold under the counter, at least. The one that I've actually just illustrated there, Eustace Chesser's Love Without Fear, originally in 1941, talks very much about how sexual satisfaction can be enhanced, can be developed. It actually sold 3 million copies by 1964. It was sold primarily through mail order and through backstreet shops. So again, that sort of knowledge of how people actually behave, what sexual activity is about, and so on and so forth. Many men had always assumed, partly due to the literature and the prevailing patriarchy at the time, that once married, they could have sex on demand, and the woman's role was passive. Woman's duty, love and beauty, and so on. But by the 1950s and 1960s, those ideas were changing. Now, that may be because women had been more independent during the war years, and many of them had had affairs. It may be there was also just a general weakening of the church. Again, that notion of the church and state. Think back to the opening of Look Back in Anger and the sort of sense of the establishment of the state, etc. Or it may simply be just the demands of a changing world and changing expectations and changing opportunities. Clearly recognising that there was a challenge, certainly in the 1940s, during the war, the Marriage Guidance Council was actually formed in 1943. It was set up and established by the government to help support marriages in trouble and to give advice on sex. Clearly that's important because if marriages had failed, people in any case had to soldier on in them because divorce certainly was not easily available. Definitely not for the middle and working classes. It was a very expensive, very problematic issue. Even actually after 1949, when legal aid first became available, the grounds for a divorce were twofold, adultery and desertion. And you had to have proof of both. So you had a whole range of private detectives following partners and sorting out sort of evidence so they could actually prove either adultery or indeed aspects of irretrievable breakdown. Actually, it wasn't until 1969 in divorce law that actually the notion and the whole idea of a guilty party was actually dropped, and proof of an irretrievable breakdown was actually enough to secure divorce. And again, there are arguments for and against. Some people say it was a lot more solid society when we actually had those structures of the family and so on, again, as opposed to the more, shall we say, fluid issues that we actually tend to enjoy today. So the fact of the matter was that in the 1950s, sex outside marriage certainly happened. But it was still considered immoral by many and sinful by some. The very notion of living together in a relationship would have been deemed living in sin from that perspective. People's general standards, looking by the sort of text and letters and things of the time, tended to have been high. But actually, polls at the time suggested that over half of adults would indulge in sex before marriage. So far, so expected, one might well say. But there were two types of sexual behaviour in particular that created great anxiety. And they were prostitution and homosexuality. In other words, selling sex and same-sex relationships between men. During the preparations for the Festival of Britain, which you may recall I launched with back in the day, that big sort of grand scenario, there was literally a major panic in 1950, and the authorities were very worried that prostitutes might pester the tourists. They were seen as a threat to social stability. We're seeing a kind of echoing of the kind of issues that were being raised within the 1800s, the late 1800s, etc., 1880s, 1890s, and so on. So inevitably attempts were made to drive prostitutes off the streets, and there were many thousands of convictions for street offences, for soliciting, and so on and so forth. Similarly, homosexuality, a major moral dilemma. In April 1954, things had got so serious that the government appointed a committee under Sir John Wolfenden to examine the treatments of prostitutes and homosexuals by society. again, you might think, fine, maybe an indication that perhaps we're progressing. Well, John Wolfenden was Vice-Chancellor of Reading University at the time. He was also a Christian, and he believed in the sanctity of marriage. So you might possibly say there's a slight bias coming into that side of things. He also seems to be, perhaps most notably, and this is quite interesting from an academic point of view, really uncomfortable with the actual words homosexual and prostitute. So he would always refer to them by the euphemisms Huntley and Palmer's, because he couldn't even say the word. He certainly looked like a man who reflected what we would now refer to as the moral majority, the kind of echoes that we see within Mary Whitehouse in the 1960s, Lord Longford, and so on, and the notion of people who maintain that it's the right way forward, this is the only way forward, this is the reflection of the will of the majority. But he was also increasingly concerned on a personal level that his son, Jeremy, was indeed a homosexual. And he wrote to Jeremy with two requests in letters which have been accessed, asking Jeremy to stay out of his way for the time of the report, and to wear less makeup. You're kind of seeing something traditionally British in this after a fashion, thinking, hypocrisy, maybe. The Wolfenden Report, which again was launched in April 1954, was finally published 3 years later in 1957. And the committee came up with the following conclusions. It lamented the loosening of moral standards since the Second World War. It also lamented and regretted the weakening of the family, which they saw very much as the cornerstone of British society. And they recommended that the laws on prostitution should be tightened and penalties for prostitution increased. However, they also recommended that homosexuality should lose its criminal status. Again, there's a lot of issues here with people losing their jobs, their homes, their houses, their livelihoods, etc. But only as long as it was seen as a private affair and carried out privately. So effectively what Wolfenden was doing in this report was suggesting that there was a principle in which sexual behaviour was public and the state could interfere where it was public, but where it was private, the state should not interfere. So there was a separation between the public and the private. Interestingly enough, at the time, the Sunday Times actually refers to the Wolfenden Report as the Pansies Charter, a somewhat derogatory term. And indeed, the Street Offences Act of 1959 drove prostitutes off the streets but into brothels or cheap hotels. Now, for homosexuals as it stood, the law effectively amounted to a blackmailer's charter. Vulnerable men who tried to hide their leanings were open to extortion by people who would threaten to out them. And this is reflected by the very daring role of Dirk Bogart in the film Victim. It was the first British film to actually deal explicitly with homosexuality. And it arrived in the wake of the public debate following the publication of the Wolfenden Report in 1957. Now, for Dirk Bogart, who was a matinee idol, and very much a kind of flavour of the sort of wonderful screen set and so on, to actually sign on to play the lead character was a very brave decision. The first actor who was approached, who we don't quite know who he was, actually had declined that, because it was a brave decision, particularly given rumours about Dirk Bogart's own homosexuality. The prevailing viewpoint, and the accepted viewpoint, as we can see time and time again, was that homosexuality was an illness, it was a mental disorder, and the majority of people would be hostile towards it. The only people who seemed to be claiming for tolerance were some upper middle class homosexuals who would openly campaign for change. In fact, in 1958, 33 fairly eminent political and cultural figures sent an open letter to the Times calling for a reform in the law. And they included such people as Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, the historian A.J.P. Taylor, as well as the bishops of Birmingham and Exeter. And that group, which began to emerge in the late 50s, formed the basis of the Homosexual Law Reform Society. They would campaign tirelessly for change and push a succession of bills that all failed in Parliament. Again, it wasn't decriminalised until the end of the 60s. Despite the recommendations of the Wolfenden Report and the Reform Society, and the great success of this film, Victim, which is well worth seeing, you can access it sort of relatively straightforwardly, homosexuality remained an imprisonable offence until 1967. If you were actually identified as being a homosexual, you would be sent to jail. End of. That's what happened to Oscar Wilde. It's a fact of the matter. The Sexual Offences Act of 1967 didn't make homosexuals equal. It simply decriminalised acts between consenting adults aged 21 or above. And any cruising of public spaces and cottaging would remain offences. That was in England in 1967. Scotland didn't actually change the law until 1980. And Northern Ireland waited until 1982. Again, following the sort of pattern from that point of view. And that's the state of play with respect to the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, of course, right in the heart of Vietnam and the end of the 60s and so on, you have a whole range of other aspects going. Certainly in the 60s, there was a very well-established gay community in Greenwich Village in New York, which had its own gay bar, which is entitled the Stonewall. You see it there. However, men who visited the bar were constantly being harassed by the police. Again, there was an illegality question with respect to that. And on the 27th of June 1969, the gays effectively responded with what is now known as the Stonewall Riots. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because it actually marks the beginning of what we now see and now look back on as the Gay Liberation Front, the GLF. Again, it's tying in also similarly, as we'll see in a few seconds, with respect to women's rights as well. The Gay Liberation Front was also founded in Britain in 1970, and it campaigned for homosexuality to be recognised as a valid sexual orientation. Again, quite an interesting sort of line from that. A survey of the under 45s in 1969 found that only 12% of the population could even stand to be in the same room as a homosexual. 12% were tolerant of homosexuality. 24%, so just under a quarter, were totally revolted. And 22% would pity homosexuals as people suffering from an illness. So quite a sort of shift in terms of attitudes to actually cope with from that point of view. Now, despite that prejudice, and the lines that go along with prejudice, obviously, prejudgment, Gay Lib was actually very successful in spreading its message. Surveys show that gay men in Britain and the United States amounted to roughly about 3% of the male population, 3 in every 100. So again, minority from that point of view. And that minority probably even makes the success of the movement in changing attitudes quite surprising. There are various theories in terms of, yes, but most gay men would actually mitigate to work within the movie industry, with the theatre industry, etc. So they're working in industries that effectively kind of were dealing with manipulation on one level. But that's, again, another argument possibly for another day. It's fair to say that, in general, moral attitudes in the 60s pretty much remained fairly stable, despite the changing aspects and things, as we'll see when we look in subsequent weeks at the swinging 60s and the elements within that. If we look at the figures, roughly about 25% of men and 60% of women would remain virgins until marriage. Only one in four girls actually approved of premarital sex. Very few people in the overall population would be seen as promiscuous. It's the old line about, well, the party's going on elsewhere, and so on. And most sexual activity was genuinely related to steady relationships, despite, again, the sort of suggestion that things were taking place elsewhere. However, maybe that's at the heart of the notion of the 60s had this notion of being a promiscuous era. The media had also expanded massively. Sex was being discussed more openly, particularly in relationship to the promiscuous minority. As I said, most people had steady relationships, which often led to marriage. But this so-called sexual revolution, as Sandbrook would say, often happened in the newspapers. Again, it's the scandal sheets. It's the notion of those histories of journalism that titillate, that actually sort of pique people's interests, and so on and so forth. 77% of those polled also thought that sex as a topic got far too much publicity. Now, up until the 1960s, feminists had concentrated on specific objectives. Those objectives were the vote, equal rights in education and the workplace, the value of women as homemakers, mothers, and so on. As I mentioned, women had mobilised in the Second World War as they did in the First World War. They would go out into the workplace to keep the war effort going at home. And after the war, the returning heroes obviously needed jobs, so the women were unceremoniously often shoved back into the home as well. Did it once, twice. Media-wise, we're looking at another sort of level of aspects. Dior, very well-known fashion house, would promote this new look for a new generation of women and so on. Clothing which would very much suit the attitudes of the time, and often looking at fashion and how that develops, sort of fashion historians that can develop a whole range of things in terms of what elements are drawn on and how things are being perceived. Advertisers certainly were quite clear in this. They saw women as shoppers. There's a market there. I mean, I suppose we recently heard, or the last few years, we've heard about the pink pound and the sort of things that comes across on that sort of basis. If you've got a particular sort of aspect, you can target a group of people and they'll buy stuff which relates to you. Teenage magazines, as we've seen, were also relentless in promoting marriage as the ultimate culmination of female success. Now, that's ultimately where you're heading for. Get the man, capture the man, keep the man, have children, end. And women's magazines would revisit the same themes over and over again. How to get a man, how to keep him, how to create the perfect home, how to stay beautiful, how to raise children. And often there was a kind of suggestion that the working wife was a failing wife, that actually you can't do both, you can't work on that basis. The Shirley Conran superwoman was maybe possibly one level, but not really useful. In industry, women felt marginalised, where often, as we saw, again, I returned back to that Kellogg's commercial, the women would type the letters, but they wouldn't dictate them. In politics, they type the letters and they make the tea, but they'd rarely make the speeches. Femininity, as an aspect, certainly would get in the way of business. And feminism would get in the way of the class struggle, again, from the Labour ideology or indeed the Conservative ideology. And it's interesting, accordingly, that the women's liberation movement actually emerged out of student politics in 1968, which again we'll start coming back to. Much of the inspiration for the women's lib movement came from the United States, and this is one of the reasons why, if you select the question about women's liberation movement being intentionally ideological, international, and so on, be careful that you bear in mind that this is a particular Western aspect of women's liberation, that there were huge areas of the globe, as there still are, where equality is not even talked about, it's not on the agenda. So again, it's something to bear in mind from that point of view. But issues such as the civil rights movement, again, Martin Luther King, the Rosa Parks protest, etc., the notion that peaceful change could actually create an impact upon society's viewpoint was beginning to be seen as a useful success strategy. Indeed, even Chris Packer mentioned that actually it was the 1960s results, and indeed prior to that, Gandhi in 1940, that was partially motivating his involvement with the Extinction Agenda line of protests and so on and so forth. Certainly it's fair to say that the National Organization of Women was set up in 1966, and they were also trivialized for protests such as the Miss America pageant where they'd have the ceremonial burning of bras. Why burn bras? Well, bras were designed by men. They were designed to actually make the female cleavage look more like the female buttocks and therefore become more attractive, and therefore they become systems of oppression and so on. Now, I'm kind of stating some of the extremes here, but at the end of the day, that's one of the reasons why actually burning the bra was seen as symbolic to actually set your sisters free, the line from that point of view, and so on. And understandably, the media would trivialise this. They would effectively say that, you know, this was not a serious organisation aiming for equality, etc. However, the first American National Women's Liberation Conference in 1968 actually did demonstrate that there were steps being made to seek genuine equality in society, you know, for all women, all men, and so on. As I mentioned, in the 1960s, and you look at the majority of product at the time, you'll find that public life and the workplace were dominated by males. Films had male narratives, they had male directors, not exclusively. There were a number of notable exceptions, and again, we'll come on to that. But in terms of those exceptions, it's still interesting in terms of how women are being portrayed, what's being developed, etc. Films and film and television were usually portrayed as stereotypes. They were either housewives, They were either battle axers, they were either individuals who were there purely as eye candy. There were a number of kind of clear classic stereotypes which were being developed, etc. The women in the main needed to be protected and rescued by the male protagonists. And arguably in James Bond, women were primarily window dressing. Again, it's an interesting line in terms of where things are going. Even if we take a very popular series of the time, which we'll have a look at again later on today, we're looking to develop our notion of how things are going, how protests are developed. Some of the key things that we've got there, let's judge ourselves as people, consumer con game, Pepsi Cola, and so on. If you want meat, go to the butcher, etc. Really significant aspects, again, coming from a student protest. And they said, well, what's the problem on TV? You've got these characters. You've got Diana Rigg, Emma Peel. Actually, the character of Diana Rigg, Emma Peel, it's male appeal and so on, and Honor Blackman as Kathy Gale, etc. Now, these were women who clearly kicked ass. They were precursors very much of the sort of current incarnation of the cinematic women, the equivalent of the Linda Hamilton character, the Ripley character of Sigourney Weaver, and so on and so forth. There were women who fought them for themselves. And also there were style and fashion icons, whether it was leather catsuits, whether it was 60s fashion, etc. They certainly echoed that whole system. But ultimately, in The Avengers, the TV series, the jet set up, of course, by Sidney Newman before he went over to Doctor Who, there was a sense that actually what we had here was a fantasy. It was a surrealist fantasy insofar as it was all very good for the 50 minutes or so of the show to actually see how these characters were developed. And Tara King, obviously, played by Linda Thorson afterwards, etc. Kathy Gale was represented as a widow. Emma Peel eventually returned at the end of the series to her husband, who was missing on an exploration, etc. And there is that notion in terms of to what extent did this accurately reflect reality, or was it actually more important, perhaps, and maybe inspiring, maybe actually suggesting that, yeah, you could have a kind of equality. Because, I mean, John Steed, chap with the bowler, played by Patrick McNee, and his companion were pretty much equals in terms of where things are going. Something which really didn't re-emerge in terms of popular culture until the 90s with Chris Carter's X-Files and Dana Scully and Fox Mulder and so on. So, again, an interesting take on that. I mentioned Oz earlier. Well, they also took a particular line, but again, they were going for shock value. Underground magazines such as Oz would give space to women, in terms of column inches and so on, but more often, as we see here, they were, again, used as sexual icons, rather than actually promoting feminism. And as a result, many women, perhaps rightly, felt marginalised. How do you relate to Britain's first inflatable woman? I don't know. The London Women's Liberation Workshop was actually formed in 1969. So you can see a lot of organisations being formed and developed around here to start developing the notion, pushing very strongly to ensure that development was really moved forward and so on. And 2 years after the Summer of Love, which we'll talk about in 1967 and so on. And in the first year of its operation, the London's Women's Liberation Workshop started to publish its newsletter, which was called Shrew, S-H-R-E-W, which I'm sure Shakespearean scholars will say, after the Taming of the Shrew, absolutely. You know, the notion of the sort of character that comes through that, so we'll quote that. As opposed, of course, to the shrew, which is a little small field animal, much more cute, but never mind, it's not a lie entirely. Now, the problem of misrepresentation of women in the press and the promotion of female stereotypes, and also in 1969 we see the launch of The Revamped Sun with Larry Lamb and Rupert Murdoch saying, let's put a topless woman on page 3, etc., etc., etc. The problem with that sort of aspect means that the existence of publications like Shrew and other prominent magazines like Spare Rib, which was launched in 1972, kind of makes them even more important, because it takes not just a countercultural but a counter-ideological position on these things. And it allowed the women's liberation movement a platform for self-representation. And also on the back of media headlines generated by direct action, like the bra burning and so on and so forth, it also enabled them to reach a wider female audience. And feminist magazines would also provide alternatives to typical women's magazines of the time, which again hadn't really changed much in their outlook or ideology since the 1920s. You know, the ideal vacuum cleaner, the ideal makeup, and so on. In 1968, looking at a class system, a movie that was actually made as Made in Dagenham a few years ago, and it's still available as consumption, obviously, was the Ford Sewing Machinist Strike of 1968. This was basically where all the women at Ford plants came out on strike and managed to secure 95% of the rate that men were being paid. So actually, they had a success. I think it was seen as a success. It wasn't total equality, but they did actually get 95% of the rate that their male counterparts were getting for pretty much the same online factory jobs, etc. Now, because these women were working class, it also tended to draw the attention of the press, and they became a bit of a cause célèbre, because these were not glamorous individuals a la Vanessa Redgrave, a la the Richardson family, a la people who were sort of making points of the thing. These were ordinary, everyday citizens, and it became an interesting sort of area in which, you know, the trade unions also started to look at the plight of women a bit more seriously and actually take the sort of issues to conference and so on and so forth. So you're getting this whole notion, hang on, yes, actually there are a large number of people here who do merit equal treatment, equal pay, and so on. By 1969, the women's liberation movement was building up around a network of about 70 small groups that would actually meet often in each other's homes to discuss issues specifically related to feminism and so on. Many of the members of the groups also felt stifled by their roles as housewives and mothers, but again, at least they could actually sort of address various other aspects. Now, in terms of the overriding society, it's fair to say that men still had the jobs, they had the money, they had the power. Women would be married at an average age of 22, again, partly pressurised by the happy endings, because if you don't get married by 22, you're going to be on the shelf, blah, 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 etc. Happy endings promised in women's magazines, romantic novels, etc. But they often found that actually marriage was not what they hoped, that ideal, the Prince Charming notion. Although it's great that, you know, only a matter of hours now before Frozen 2 emerges. Sorry. But it's a great movie, let's face it. You know, let it go. In terms of the sort of issues that are coming to them, what we see in this particular instance, when you find that the dream isn't what you hoped it would be, and you know, there's more to life than that, and maybe you need to address that. For active women in careers, the pressure to become liberated sex objects as well was substantial. In other words, to equal a male, and this was an argument put forward by men at the time, a woman had to be equally sexually liberated. So there was actually a pressure to be promiscuous. You know, the pressure of miniskirts and mascara could be seen as just new forms of oppression, because actually you're not satisfying your own particular sort of desires. I mean, it's great if you are, but it's a kind of, it's, you're into the notion of Laura Mulvey and the look and aspects relating to that. The first Women's Liberation Movement conference in Britain actually was held in Oxford in 1970. And it was at that conference that the British Women's National Coordination Committee drew up four demands. What horrendous demands could this be, which took such a long time to actually get into operation, you may well ask. And I will tell you. The first one, equal pay. So equal pay, demand number one. Second one, free contraception and abortion on demand. Third one, equal education and job opportunities. And the fourth one, free 24-hour childcare. Now, again, you can judge for yourself in terms of how far you come with respect to that. The movement's demands were printed on banners and on a petition that was handed to the Prime Minister, who at the time was Harold Wilson, on the 6th of March 1971, when 4,000 women marched through London on what became the movement's first International Women's Day March. And that's when it all started, in many ways, in terms of the 6th of March on an annual basis, the sort of celebration of International Women's Day. This is where the sort of roots were there. And you can see from some of the banners here, in terms of sexism is alive and well, or alive and living in Australia and so on, the internationalisation was very much developed from that point of view. Clearly the politicians were going to react to this in a way which opens up a whole range of other aspects as well. And in 1970, the Equal Pay Act was actually passed. In other words, women would receive the same pay for the same job as men were doing. Great, but it wasn't actually enacted or put into practice until 1975. Why was there a five-year gap? Well, to allow the employers time to consider the implications. I can't possibly afford to pay women the same as men. It's going to end this all. It remained again pretty much in a kind of fairly easygoing routine until it was beefed up again in 1983 to include comparable jobs with different job titles. So the facts remain in terms of the last quarter of the 20th century, that in the 1970s and beyond, women were discriminated against in most areas of life. They were mostly trapped in low-pay, low-skill jobs. So there were many challenges that obviously lay ahead in terms of that. Nevertheless, it needs to be acknowledged that the movement gradually, emphasis on the gradually, brought about significant change. They included such things as the 1975 Sex Discrimination Act, which actually was passed in 1975 and outlawed sexual discrimination in the workplace. So you couldn't sort of ignore women candidates because they were women. Also in 1976, perhaps equally significantly, some might say even more, the Domestic Violence Act was passed in 1976, which enabled married or cohabiting women to obtain a court order, which was primarily aimed at preventing further violence and to exclude their violent partner from the home. So again, there are signs that things are developing, growing through this. Where we actually sort of move on to is again a subject for discussion and debate. But I want to actually sort of bridge the sort of the lecture bit with, as promised, an aspect of The Avengers. And I want to screen the first 15 minutes of this particular episode. Now, I'll give you a bit of backstory in terms of The Avengers, who they are, what they are, what they're about, and so on. And primarily what we actually have here is a series which was hugely, hugely popular. It opened up a whole range of areas, and also opened up the whole aspect of British culture overseas. When we come to the 1960s, we'll see how the Beatles very much sort of opened up a whole range of things as well, and kind of really celebrated the 60s. I mean, one of the most positive lectures that we come to is probably in a couple of weeks' time when we start talking about the 60s in general. The series itself, which very much relates to the 60s, opens up with the main protagonists of John Steed and in this Emma Peel, or a female partner. And it was obviously sold from a point of view of it was a colour series, it was a bright, sparkly series, I mean, the first few episodes would. But I want to, as we watch this, just pick up on a few key things. First of all, do a straight numerical count. How many women do we see represented? Okay. What sort of character of women actually are there? How are they sort of being portrayed, etc.? And perhaps more significantly also, let's talk about how they are, or how the narrative reinforces what we could argue would be class consciousness. Now, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but it's worthwhile noting that this is an image that was being produced in terms of Britain at the time. Okay. So, just this is all. Now, pop quiz question. How do we know, or how could we identify, that this is a series made in Britain, about British people, etc., that's being made very much for export overseas, particularly to the American market? Absolutely. Very much so. You know, when this was being transmitted, very few people in Britain, although it was a very popular series, Saturday Nights and so on, they wouldn't have colour television sets. The colour didn't really start. I mean, one or two might at that end. And you've also got the notion of the Red Rose, very patriotic there, Red Rose of England, etc., in the gun, you know, very stylishly produced sort of line from that point of view. And obviously it's got the whole notion of the Avengers, nothing to do with Captain America, nothing to do with the Marvel thing. Again, that's one of the reasons why when Joss Whedon's movie was released here legally, he could not call it the Avengers.